Over the last couple of days, we have talked about challenges associated with diagnosing adults with mental health conditions. And yesterday, we talked about challenges associated with diagnosing children with mental health conditions. But today, we're going to kind of turn the camera around to us.
We're worried about this one.
Yeah.
I'm worried about because we're going to talk about the errors that we make as professionals.
The errors that professionals and factors associated with clinicians that contribute to misdiagnoses.
Right. And this whole week has been devoted to misdiagnoses and the difficulties with making an accurate diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So a couple of issues, making the wrong diagnosis, diagnosis or missing a diagnosis altogether. And in fact, this is an important issue. And in September of 2015, publication was put out by the American Academy of Medicine, Engineering, and Sciences entitled Misdiagnosis in Healthcare, Healthcare Overall, including psychiatry. And in that publication, the authors say that we don't really know, and you and I have said that all week, we don't really know the rate of misdiagnoses, but what they said in this article is that there are enough misdiagnoses made that it is likely that you will have a significant misdiagnosis at some point. That every person will have a significant misdiagnosis at some time in their life. Which is scary. Because it always comes at the wrong time, of course. But we said the other day in one of our earlier podcasts that we don't have accurate data. And previously, in the old days, you know, the good old days that people always talk about, you could put in a medical record what the cause of death was, and you could say natural causes, and nobody would question that. Well, today people are beginning to question those things, and so we don't really have accurate data on how many missed diagnoses there are. But we're going to talk today about the mistakes that we make as clinicians that contribute to misdiagnosis.
And we want to kind of first off mention that we're not talking about malpractice. Malpractice is someone who is untrained, who is, you know, making, I was just going to say, egregious errors.
Fundamental errors.
You know, it makes me think of a couple of years ago, maybe even longer, maybe 10 years ago or so, when, you know, that whole thing came out that a patient went in for surgery because a part of one leg had to be amputated or something, and they amputated the wrong leg. That's not what we're talking about here, because that's a very different...
I had to have knee surgery a few years ago, and man, they had it. They've had me draw with ink, marker, my pens, and arrows, and which leg to operate on. And they must have asked me 10 times who I was and why I was there and what leg. And that was after. And was right after that.
And the right marker with a marker on it. This leg, not this leg.
I put arrows down there, you know. But it was right after that that very, very sad episode. And there's so many dramatic cases where misdiagnoses. Now, surgery, of course, it's even, they're all of consequence. I would sure hate to have the wrong leg amputated. You can't stitch it back on.
You can't undo that.
Right.
So, but so we're not talking about that type of malpractice.
Although it... medical errors are the major reason for medical malpractice suits, and they contribute. They are responsible for 10% of all unexpected deaths. Right. So it is of some significance. We just don't know exactly what the number is. But we know that it's occurring. We know that it's occurring far more often than it should. I knew a pharmacist one time who told me that. Pharmacy used to have a 0% error rate, that the pharmacist just knew that you just don't make a mistake because of the consequences. I have a feeling that there's some new adjustment that has been made mm-hmm. to accept a certain percentage of error. Right. That it's, I don't know what the percentage would be, but they're not, but the companies are not holding their pharmacists to a 0% rejection rate.
Well,
or error rate.
Purely, just purely the number of patients that you have.
That's
there's,
right.
There's bound to be an error somewhere.
We talked about that the other day, that there are, since medicine became a business, that the business part of medical clinics are dictating how many patients you have to see every hour. They've worked out the finances so that you have to see X number of patients per hour. Well, when you're told that you only have 15 minutes to see a patient, it limits what you can do.
Absolutely.
And it limits how many questions you can ask.
Right.
Okay? And you may have to, the clock may tick before you're finished with your assessment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a system problem.
Right.
What we want to talk about today are the errors that we make
right.
because of our human frailties and fallibilities.
Right. Some of them are systems-based. Like
right.
the first one we're going to talk about, and this is from an article in from MD Edge.
Right.
And it lists a number of things that are sort of clinician-derived causes of misdiagnoses, and the first one is rushing to a diagnosis.
That's right.
And we've talked about that several times this week already, but it is a major issue for situations where we are billing insurance, especially
right.
because we have, and that to me is a systems issue.
Right.
You know, if I could get away with not diagnosing somebody mm-hmm. in the first session, I wouldn't because
I would never do it.
I don't always have enough information.
Right.
And so, you know, I've had cases this week with patients
sure.
where they're referred by another physician or by from some other source, and they have a long history of having a particular diagnosis, and
right.
it's just not there.
That's not the diagnosis.
And, right. and so they come in with something and that's with a diagnosis that's not really there, but you know, you have to wonder how much of that is because you have to diagnose them with something mm-hmm. or else you're not going to right. be reimbursed for that service.
Yeah, and then the patient gets
right.
the bill. But when we rush to a diagnosis, what the mistake that we often make or can make is that we say, oh, I've seen this before.
Mm-hmm.
I know what
right.
this is. And it's this. It's
right.
A. It's diagnosis A. And you're right. It is. But you didn't spend enough time to see what else
right.
might be happening
mm-hmm.
or what's contributing to
right.
it or where it came from. And so you might not have the wrong diagnosis, it just may be an incomplete diagnosis.
Right.
Right. Because we want to, you know,
right.
we're so sure that we're right because we've seen it many times before.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And because of those factors associated with you have 15 minutes
sure.
or you have a limited mm-hmm. amount of time to see the patient
right.
and you know you have to you have to give a diagnosis,
right.
you know, when you check off
mm-hmm.
these boxes, and it's like,
right.
okay, well, yeah, that must be that.
Right.
And then you go on and...
But that's what managed care has done. Right now, medicine is being dictated by insurance companies
right.
who reimburse for what they think they should reimburse for rather than what's actually going on.
Mm-hmm.
And businesswomen, who now run medical clinics
right.
as a business rather than as
right.
a clinical service.
Right.
That's what's driving it. If anybody gets angry, I wouldn't spend too much of my energy getting angry at the clinician.
Mm-hmm.
Think about the business environment that professional is working in.
Right.
Not to excuse our mistakes. I would never do that. But many places are driven. Having said that, that's one of the reasons you and I want to do our own practice is because
right.
we didn't have to. We're not run by businessmen.
Right.
Ours is a clinical practice.
Yeah.
So,
but none of us here are business people.
Right. I can assure you.
We have no idea what we're doing.
We can assure you we're not business people. Fortunately, we have other people taking care of that, but not us. But rushing to a diagnosis
mm-hmm.
is the first problem.
Right.
Second?
The next one is, again, something that many clinicians do, and that is we fail to look at some of the cognitive factors that could
right.
contribute to the patient's presentation. You
know,
we know from the neuropsychological literature that cognitive skills and things like learning and executive function and some of those kinds of things are intricately connected
mm-hmm.
to mental health and psychiatric conditions.
Right.
But yet, rarely do clinicians explore much of that during their first session or two.
Sometimes you don't have to. You know, if you're working with a college professor who's been at it for 15 years and has a family, or a businessman mm-hmm. who's successfully right. running a company, you know that their cognitive abilities are probably right. within some range. However, with young children, mm-hmm. The elderly,
yeah.
There are times where you want to do, you don't have to do a comprehensive assessment mm-hmm. on every patient. But there are times when your clinical skills should say, I'd like to know more about this person,
right.
okay? And you will want to do some additional testing,
right.
especially in the elderly. I think that's where it's most right. applicable.
Mm-hmm. The next thing is conducting a complete and
right.
an appropriate differential mm-hmm. diagnosis.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We've mentioned many times before that there is a great deal of overlaps symptom-wise mm-hmm. Between a lot of different disorders.
Correct.
And there are ways, strategies, methods, approaches that you can use to differentiate between different things. Now, certainly the information that the patient gives you is going to guide some of that,
mm-hmm.
but, mm-hmm. I know of many clinicians who, if a patient comes in and says, well, I have mood swings, they almost immediately go towards a diagnosis of bipolar disorder.
That's right.
When mood swings can be borderline personality disorder, it could be bipolar disorder, it could be depression, it could be lots of different things, but they don't do an effective differential diagnosis
right.
to see what's really going on.
Right, and that relates back to the first one, rushing
right.
to diagnosis.
Right.
You don't do an accurate and adequate differential diagnosis.
Right.
I'm doing a talk in a month or so, and we're going to talk at length about making an mm-hmm. accurate differential diagnosis.
Right.
It's absolutely essential, because differential diagnosis leads to differential intervention.
Right.
You don't do the same thing with every patient.
Absolutely.
So,
now the next thing is more specific to psychiatrists, and that is putting patients on medications, and especially high doses of medications, right away.
Right away. Right.
Now, the I don't want to be too blaming, but many times patients come in and medication is all they want. I have certainly
right.
worked with enough
sure.
in enough clinics to have seen where patients come in and, for lack of a better word, demand being put on a medication immediately. They don't want to talk to anybody about it. They know in air quotes. They know what's going on, and
they
so they just want medication.
And they know what they want.
And they know what they want by name and dose.
What I'm getting more often these days is they want medical marijuana. That's one of the things that people.
Right.
I really need medical marijuana.
Right.
It's the only thing that really presses. Really, we're getting a lot of pressure now for medical marijuana.
Right.
But,
right.
So
that's a big issue.
Right.
Is the overuse
mm-hmm.
overuse of psychiatric medications.
Mm-hmm.
And we have situations now too where even general practitioners are using
right.
psychotropic medications
mm-hmm.
For managing patients. So
right.
you're seeing that, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah. I was thinking about EMTs, and because they have all these stories about drug addicts who
right.
they feign an illness
mm-hmm.
so that they can get drugs,
right.
prescription drugs, because
right.
they're abusing, and they have all kinds of stories about that. But we have to be careful as clinicians that, and one of the mistakes that psychiatrists make, we're not picking on psychiatrists because we're all mental health providers,
mm-hmm.
but yeah, starting at too high a dose of the wrong medication, because you don't really know, we don't have the technology to say, how much medication should you take?
Right.
Okay. It depends on your gut enzymes and
mm-hmm,
some other complicated
mm-hmm.
genetic things. And so start with a low dose. If that works, that's good, because you minimize side effects.
Right.
So,
yeah.
And these medications all have side effects.
Well, the other thing is, and this is the next one, is that not just putting them on high doses of medications right away, but using multiple medications right away.
That's right.
Polypharmacy.
Yeah. When you have a symptom reduction goal,
mm-hmm.
in other words, I just want to reduce your symptoms. I have the capacity to reduce your symptoms.
Right.
That's what medications do. They mm-hmm. reduce symptoms. So if you have three symptoms, I have a medication for each symptom. So right. we understand why it works.
Right.
But monotherapy is always preferable to polypharmacy. You know,
so right.
Keep it at one.
Right. You know, as we're thinking about psychiatry, and this is MD Edge, so it's about psychiatrists. It's right. not necessarily about therapists.
Right.
You know, there are many. The list goes on, and to include lots of different medication related mm-hmm. issues, mm-hmm. using benzodiazepines right away, using other potentially addictive medications right away. Those are often seen as issues.
As therapists and teachers, we have a particular bias against Xanax,
right.
okay? And, you know, we know Xanax was developed to mm-hmm. be a bridge. It wasn't right. meant to be used long-term. But many people take Xanax for years and years. I knew a woman who had taken Xanax for over 20 years.
Right.
And those medications were not meant to be used that way.
Right.
There's a potential for abuse. There's a potential you develop a tolerance for right. it, so you have to keep increasing the dose. So using drugs like that is a problem in psychiatry.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a lot of the other on this list go through different medications, different concerns about medications,
right.
You know, increasing the dose too quickly, lowering the doses too quickly,
right.
Using different types of medication.
There's one that's very interesting that,
yeah.
that I hadn't seen this word before. Selecting an obesogenic drug. And I thought, what is I think I know what obesogenic means, but of course, what it means is a drug that where the side effect is rapid weight gain.
Right. This is especially true with the antipsychotics and some of the mood stabilizers.
All those mood stabilizers mm-hmm. Carry the potential mm-hmm. of a rapid, and when we say rapid, we mean 40 pounds in a month.
Right.
Okay. It's astonishing how quickly you gain weight. The problem is not just weight gain. It is if you're a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, especially if you're a girl, but it affects both boys and girls
right.
who are teenagers
right.
because body image is so important. It's not just the weight gain. It's that you create metabolic problems. I mean, you can right. actually create diabetes with some of these medications.
Right. And in boys, some of those medications, for example, create a side effect referred to as gynecomastia,
right.
Where boys will develop female-appearing breasts.
Breasts, right.
And it's a bad, especially when you're talking about middle school and teenagers.
Going to gym class?
Yeah.
And taking your shirt off in front of all those middle school boys?
Right.
What a trauma that would be.
Right. You know, so
they're not without consequences.
Right. So there's those things related to medications. Were there any others that you wanted to mention?
Because there was
a few other things.
There was one at the end of the article, and I'm not sure why they did it this way, but at the end of the article, they talk about there's three other things, you know, and I don't know why they added them as other.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure why, but one
they
of them was
have 10.
I guess
and that would have made it 12. So.
It would have been 13, right? One is not collaborating with the primary care provider.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that's a problem for all of us.
Right.
We work with many school children, and we know how important it is to collaborate mm-hmm. with other professionals,
right.
with schools, with teachers, with other psychologists, with psychiatrists. I had a patient the other day who was referred by his psychiatrist,
mm-hmm.
and he said, you need to go talk to somebody mm-hmm. about this. It wasn't something that he does,
mm-hmm.
but he said, you know, this isn't a medication issue. This is a therapy mm-hmm. issue, a psychotherapy issue. And so, but he and I have that easy relationship,
mm-hmm.
and that's what
mm-hmm.
you need. Frequently, there's a contentious relationship mm-hmm. between professionals that shouldn't exist.
Right.
So that's another thing that could be a problem, is professionals not collaborating with
right.
each other. A second is using... what would I call it? We can't do this, but not using personalized medication
right.
Policies. And by personalized, we mean there is some emerging practice today that tries to personalize medications based on genetic makeup.
Mm-hmm.
You'll utilize this medication
right.
better than this medication. So there is some of that occurring, and psychiatrists are being encouraged right. to take advantage of that technology. But the third one that I think happens with all of us is lowering expectations. Mm-hmm. And I say this frequently with severe mental disorder, what we consider more severe mental disorders, and with the elderly. I've taken care of three of four elderly parents. Mm-hmm. And in every case, they lower the expectations. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, he's 85 years old. What do you expect? Mm-hmm. Well, I expect you to do the best work you can to maximize right. his existence. Okay. Right. People say, well, she's lived a long, happy life. Mm-hmm. You know, let's let her. So we have to be careful that we don't minimize expectations.
Right.
Everybody deserves a quality of life. And just because it may look like a severe mental health issue, but with the right intervention, proper family support, everybody's life can get better. So right. So we want to avoid that error of minimizing expectations.
Right. Mm-hmm. The last couple of things that we'll mention before the podcast gets too long are some other things that are especially salient for therapists and psychologists and mm-hmm. counselors, and that is, oftentimes, individuals who are, doing therapy or working with a group of patients for particular reasons, they come from a particular school of thought, a particular right. Perspective.
Right.
When they come from that theoretical perspective, they tend to see everyone and attempt to even treat everyone from that particular theoretical model.
That's right.
And that narrows their ability to sort of comprehensively evaluate the patient.
That's right.
And so things may, if you're coming from a behavioral perspective, for example, you're going to see all of these behaviors as, all these symptoms as behaviors. And yes, there is a behavioral aspect to them, but there may also be cognitive motivations and there may be, emotional things that are happening that are contributing to it. But if you're working from that purely behavioral model, you're not going to look at those things.
And there could be medical problems. And,
right.
One of the big things in psychiatry is it a medical problem or a mental health
right.
problem, But if you tend to see everything from a single theoretical perspective, mm-hmm. you're going to miss those. And
right.
That takes us back to differential diagnosis.
Right.
The only way you can make an accurate differential diagnosis is if you consider all
right.
possibilities.
Right.
But if you're only looking at something from a single perspective, you're going to miss what's on the periphery.
Absolutely. And we know professionals who are, it's not that they're bad at their job, not
no.
saying that,
Mm-mm.
but, they come from training and from a perspective where a particular diagnosis, a particular condition,
right.
is they believe that it's much more prevalent than what the statistics say,
right.
and so they are looking for that.
Right.
they specialize in, schizophrenia or dissociative identity disorder or something like that, and so everyone they see, that's what they're looking for.
Right.
And so they will. It's sort of that phenomenon of you find what you're looking for. So if you're looking for it, you're going to see symptoms that support, it's like a confirmation bias. You're going to look for
bias,
those
right.
traits that confirm what you expect to be
right.
there. And
it's working backwards.
Yeah.
I think it's this. Now let me find the evidence.
Right.
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 Instead of what's the evidence?
Right.
And where does it lead me?
So, all of this to say, including the list that we had from the article and some of these other things that we're talking about, if you get feedback from a professional that isn't consistent with the way that you feel or what you think or it doesn't make sense to you, there is nothing wrong with getting a second opinion.
Absolutely.
There is nothing wrong with going to see someone else and saying, hey, saw somebody, this is what they said. I don't know, it doesn't feel right to me, I don't understand it, they didn't explain it in a way that made sense based on how I feel, and I just wanted to see somebody else and make sure.
I want to underscore that. There is nothing wrong with getting a second
right.
opinion. I get second opinions all the time
right.
with you
yeah.
or with somebody else, one of our other
mm-hmm.
clinicians. I mean, if I'm not sure that I'm on the right track or
right.
if I have questions, you just get that uneasy feeling that you're missing something.
Mm-hmm.
I sit down and talk to you, or I talk to Dr. Suarez or somebody else in the office, or I call a friend. You know, I have a friend who's a neurologist in Tampa, and I'll call him and say, this is what this looks like. And he'll do the same thing with me.
Right.
So we get second opinions.
Right.
So please don't ever hesitate to get a second opinion and to let people know you're getting a second opinion.
Right.
The more information you get, the more accurate the diagnosis will be.
Yeah, I often tell people, let me talk to some other people and make sure that I'm thinking about this right.
So nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
None of us are infallible.
Right. So, all right. That's it for today.
Yes.
All right.
Good week.
Yeah.
So far, we have one more.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Tomorrow is sort of the consequences of getting all this wrong.
Right.
So,
right.
What happens then? So, all right. That's it. Good job today.
Look at us. Black and white. Salt and pepper. Don't touch
you've lived
me.
A,
don't touch me.
I've what? You've lived a good life, Richard.
Oh. I wondered when he was going to say. I thought he'd wait until the camera was off.
I've been thinking about it since you said it.
Right. No, that is. Thank you. Happy Friday.
Until next time, stay happy, stay healthy, and forget to be afraid.